Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Miles Beale. How are you, Miles?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris. And you?
Yep, good. We're going to finish Brexit today, hopefully. I don't think we're going to ever finish Brexit.
I'd love to. It won't be today.
But today we're just going to finish up with Brexit. So today, Camel Valley down in Cornwall were awarded their PDO status, which means they've now got an official designation, the first single vineyard PDO in the UK. Great.
Yep. Yeah? Yep.
And that'll last for up to 2 years, possibly. You know, I think when I spoke to Bob and he had been working on this for about 10 or 15 years, you know, 10, 15 years, he's got it for a good 18 months. You know, it doesn't seem like a good return, but it raises the question about the PGIs, the Protected Geographical Indicators, you know, whether it be Melton Mowbray Port Pies or Camel Valley's wines from their vineyards. What's the WSTA's position on that?
Yeah, so great question. There's quite a lot in there. I mean, for Camel Valley, good on them. They've been working on that for, you know, as you say, a heck of a long time. It's finally come through, you know, might only last 18 months. Actually, you know, what we think will happen next with GIs generally, so all geographical indicators, whether they're PDOs or whatever else, when the UK leaves the EU, we will have to establish our own system of GIs as part of any trade agreement with the EU, particularly one that's successful. There'll have to be mutual recognition of
it's similar to the Aussies or Americans or whatever.
Quite. I mean, I think the only thing that's different, which the government keeps pointing to, is the fact that because we're, I mean, normally with a free trade deal, it's all about convergence. How do you get to the same point? Actually, for us, we're leaving the EU, so it's going to be about divergence. At the point we've left the European Union, we already recognise all their GIs and they would already recognise all of ours. We just need a parallel register. And what we'd expect to do is have a conversation with the UK government about which ones to transfer over. But the starting point would probably be, look, we have a single system shared with the EU at the moment. You just kind of split them and it's mutually recognised. Future ones, you'd have to do slightly differently. Now, I think there is a case for adding some GIs. We'd like to see a British gin GI. I think there's some case for changing some existing GIs, probably on the English wine side as well. But the real, interest for us and certainly for your listeners is at some point in the future, we're going to have mutual recognition of GIs with third countries, including Australia, but also all of the others, where we're in control of our own GI system. We don't have to talk to the EU about it. The UK government will be able to say, yes, we're happy to recognise that one. Are you going to recognise ours? So there will be more option or a greater number of options for the UK in recognising new GIs. So I think that's where it'll be quite interesting for Australia and the UK and other third countries.
Because it'll be easier for us to create new GIs.
We, the UK, will have control over our own system of GIs.
Exactly.
So we can say whether we do or don't want to recognise another one. And it's up to us to negotiate with whoever the third country is, whether to recognise, you know, more or fewer of theirs. So actually, you know, instead of having to put all of this into a big negotiation with 27 other countries in the EU, in future, it's simply a bilateral conversation.
One of the, I don't know whether it's an opportunity or not, came up and gave an example where a German producer can go to Italy, Veneto, buy some wine, brings it back, carbonates it, you know, pumping the bicycle or whatever he wants to do, and he's made some sparkling wines.
Yeah.
Lovely. If one of the big bottling factories in England, they go off and buy a load of Australian wine, they carbonate it. It's not sparkling wine, it's something else.
So that was the example I gave, I think, and it is true. And I mean that's a good example of something. Look, we're going to have to do a free trade deal with the EU, or indeed fail to do one, before we can do one with anyone else. You know, we haven't done this for 40 years.
Why do we have to do one for the EU first? Is it just because they're the most important trade partner?
Yeah, but it's also part of, you know, the UK government's position is that actually, ideally, we divorce from the EU and agree a free trade agreement because we will have left the single market all within 2 years. Now, the European Council and its negotiating guidelines have been very clear that they won't do those two things at the same time. They'll do them consecutively. So divorce first, new trading arrangements second. But both sides are committed to trying to do that trade deal before the UK, you know, leaves the single market, leaves the customs union, and we have to leave the customs union in order to set our own tariffs and do our own trade deals. So, you know, chronologically, the only way to approach this if you want a positive outcome with a European trade deal is to do that one first. It's also the most obvious one to do. I mean, you know, wine is pretty obvious. You know, half of our wine is coming from the EU. So, you know, you would want to do that one first because it's the biggest. You know, that's where we will start. But the anomaly you referred to is, I mean, you know, otherwise quite shocking. You know, you can move still wine within the single market, any of the 27 countries, and carbonate it in a different place to the source and call it sparkling wine. But under EU laws, if you bring it in from New Zealand, you cannot sparkle it, carbonate it, and then call it sparkling wine. You have to describe it differently. And that just seems to us to be, that's a good example of a non-tariff issue that creates an unlevel playing field, you know, in this case, against New Zealand wine in favour of EU wine. And we ought to be able to put that right.
Just on these funny trade barriers you get, I remember years ago, it was only maybe 10 years ago, I think it was, the Australians were doing a deal with Europe, and they, part of the deal was to acknowledge European GIs, or appellations, whatever you want to call it, and in return, Europe gave them access to their sweet wines into Europe. New Zealand, being quite a nice country, we go, well, we'll recognize your GIs, it's not a problem, we think that's fair, and then the Europeans wouldn't let our sweet wines in.
Yeah, I mean, that has reminded me of something to say about GIs generally, which is overall, the EU has probably more interest in the UK recognising all of EU GIs than vice versa.
Yeah, because
with one massive exception, and whiskey. The huge exception is Scotch whisky.
Yeah.
Because Scotch whisky is by far and away the biggest GI in the world. So now £4 billion worth of exports per annum. So there is a very interesting negotiation that will go on between the EU and the UK when the time comes about recognition, mutual recognition of GIs. You're quite right. I mean, the playing field is more unlevel for New Zealand than for Australia in one other respect. This is all about non-tariff barriers as well. But the EU has wine agreements with two developed nations, Australia on the one hand and the US on the other. And with both of those, they've removed some of the non-tariff barriers. So, for example, there are some winemaking practices undertaken in Australia that normally aren't recognised by the EU, but because there's this EU-Australia wine deal, they are recognised. The same winemaking practices in New Zealand are not recognised, so you can't ship those wines into the EU.
Do you know what the practices are?
I don't offhand. We can probably come back to you with some examples, but it for us, it's more about the principle. And, you know, the irony is, when we leave the EU, if we don't manage to, as they describe it, this is a great phrase, great government phrase, grandfather. You talk about grandfathering. So the idea is that...
The Great Repeal Bill, where basically everything gets added to our legislation.
Yes, although this is slightly more complicated because it's a trade deal, but the EU-Australia and EU-US wine agreements... in theory, the UK ought to be able to take on exactly the same arrangements if they do a sensible deal with the EU. You simply carry those on. If we fall out of the European Union and there's a hard Brexit, we'd have to go back on those. So there are some winemaking practices in Australia for wine that comes into the EU now, which if we suddenly left the EU, there may be a problem bringing those Australian wines into the UK. Now, I suspect it would be technical and you'd be able to get rid of it reasonably quickly,
yeah,
but it would be a barrier to ongoing trade. It would be a disruption. So there's another really good example of something quite practical that could mess things up in the short term if the negotiations go bad.
I always think of barriers as, for example, whenever the French get a little bit upset with the Spanish because the Spanish are sending a lot of wine up. And so on the border, they get their CRAV terrorists who just smash up the wine and don't let it into France. And I remember there was a similar issue 15, 20 years ago with fisheries, with fish being blocked as well, and beef and all this sort of, you know, mad cow disease, beef, all that sort of stuff. So these barriers can be weird and wonderful things. You know, it doesn't, all it takes is for the French police not to stop terrorists or whatever you want to call them, demonstrators, pouring out all the wine coming from Spain, for example. And then if the police don't police it, then that becomes a trade barrier, effectively.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one you can't legislate for. It probably is a French specialism, you're right. But you know, it's not, you know,
well,
it is built
into the international... Well, the Spanish and Gibraltar have the same sort of thing. Or sometimes they enforce the passport checking and they take their time and they have massive queues and sometimes they don't.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but I think that, you know, the what's really within our gift when I say ours, the UK government's, is how you negotiate the rules. Now, if someone doesn't enforce the rules, that's a different thing. You know, you have to take them to a court or other, and it takes quite a long time to resolve. But, you know, you are right. You get those sorts of things appearing, and you want to avoid them if you possibly can. I mean, I think the bit that you'll have heard me say this yesterday, the bit that we're vaguely fanatical about the WSTA is politicians can only cock this up for the industry. You know, we all want to trade on pretty much the same basis as now. We actually see a prospect at some point in the future, if we exit the EU sensibly and in an economically rational manner. You know, French, Spanish, Italian wine producers do not want to make it more difficult to export their products into the UK and onto the UK market, which is huge for them.
Yep.
So as long as that, you know, the politicians don't get in the way of that, then we will get to a second phase where the UK is able to do trade deals with the rest of the world. And in most instances, we ought to be able to make small improvements that would benefit the wine industry, irrespective of where you are in that industry, i.e. if you're in Australia or New Zealand or Argentina or the UK, it ought to be slightly better than it is now. Now, that won't happen overnight. It might take 10 years. But the point is, there ought to be improvements. In the short term, all politicians could do is cock it up. So we at the WSTA are doing our level best, working with trade associations in other countries and at European and international level, to get all governments to recognize there is an industry position that they're hearing from all angles and they simply need to accept it and facilitate it rather than use wine or indeed spirits as something they trade off against another industry. You know, if wine is held to ransom against fisheries, we have a big problem. But it's only the politicians who could do that, and we are saying to them, please don't.
It does look like EU want to decompartmentalize things, and because of the nature of their negotiating, they have to be pretty open to get all 27 countries. Our government seems to be, well, in the past, I've always had the impression that the UK government's quite happy to use anything they can to get what they want, and sometimes it's not always out in the open.
Yeah. Actually, to be honest, I don't recognize that description in that.
I'm just thinking of arms deals.
I'm happy to say I don't know so much about arms deals, but I think the sort of general view of the way the UK operates is it fights pretty hard for what it wants, but once it's enshrined in a rule, we enforce it. I think there are some inside the EU who operate in almost the opposite fashion.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's necessarily a fair description. I think. You know, the one thing that I am acutely aware of is that the UK has very little direct trade negotiating experience. I mean, in New Zealand and Australia, you do this all the time. We haven't done it for 40 years because we let the EU do it for us. So we have a hugely weak position. But one of the things I think we're doing is we're calling on friends that we trust. And I'd put New Zealand and Australia very much in that camp for experts in trade. You know, I mean, if you're a trade expert living in New Zealand or Australia or indeed anywhere else in the world, and you want a new job and come and live in London, frankly, this is a pretty good time for you. Get in touch. I'll leave you my number.
Okay, two big sides of the wine trade. There's a massive bottling plant in Bristol owned by Accolade, and they bring wines in bulk. They bottle it. And then they export some of that to Europe, don't they? It's not just for the UK consumption. It goes everywhere. How do you think that will be managed? Because that business part was set up about, well, they expanded it 2-3 years ago on the assumption that was they were going to be able to free trade the wines all over Europe.
Yeah, I mean, we think that facility, which, by the way, has just been bought by a South Korean consortium, or I think it's consortium, or certainly business. So Accolade leases it. But it's, you know, it is the biggest plant of its type, we think, in the Northern Hemisphere, certainly in the EU. I think it's fascinating. I mean, the re-exporting business is getting bigger and bigger. If you look at, you know, we think the re-export element of the UK market is about 6 or 7% of the market.
Yeah.
That's what we can see. So it's likely to be more, not less than that. And that is, we think, pretty much based upon the fact that there are a lot of companies, countries even, that use the UK as the hub for servicing a European market, possibly even a Northern Hemisphere market, as in, I think, Accolade's case to a great extent. The question is, if we leave the European Union, we're no longer inside the single market, do people change their business model? Does it make more sense for that hub to be based not in the UK but somewhere else? Now, we are making this point very strongly to government, and they get it. then it's not yet clear what they're going to do about it. In fact, it's not yet clear what they can do about it. But in the banking sector, you can already see it. You know, there are certain things that the UK banking system could do because we're inside the EU and we won't be able to do it in future. We hope that that will, you know, will not replicate itself for the wine industry. So we hope that the hub, the kind of business hub role from which this re-exporting issues will remain in the UK. That's what we're arguing for. And actually, of course, it's not just about being inside the single market. It's also about the business environment. So, you know, low corporate taxes, that sort of thing, we think should help. But that is a really big issue. And I think re-exporting is probably increasing for the UK. So it's a bit of business that, you know, generally the WSJA wants to argue to keep in the UK, but it's not a single measure that will do it.
From an environmental point of view, apart from the cost of shipping trucks, at least the more we bottle here, the more use we have of green glass, we can recycle it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, you're quite right. You know, more green glass, thinner glass, more coming over in bulk, which, you know, is more environmentally friendly, increases, you know, it allows you to increase margins as an operator operating on pretty skinny ones generally.
The last question I've got is regarding the wine trade in the UK and staff. Because if you go into a bar in London, the chances of it being someone from Cornwall is pretty slim. The chance of it being from Poland or Czechoslovakia is pretty high. So a lot of the hospitality industry in the UK is you know, staffed by immigrants.
Yeah.
Or you know, Europeans, a lot of Europeans. Yeah. Now, as a Kiwi, when I being part of the Commonwealth, I could come in here and get a 2-year work visa and I could just come in and work for 2 years as long as it wasn't in anything I was skilled in. Like, I'm an engineer, so I'm not allowed to do engineering when I first came in, but I was allowed to pour pints,
yep,
sort of thing. And the question is, given that the hospitality industry is run by foreigners almost, what do you think the implications are and what do you think the solutions will be?
So, look, I think the implications are huge. And, you know, we the UK government's... after the general election, we'll have to come forward with plans for an entirely new immigration system. It's likely to be the Conservative Party, and they have talked about some pretty draconian cuts in the numbers of immigrants. You are quite right about the hospitality sector. Just a brief point on context, which I think people miss. One of the reasons immigration was such an important issue in the Brexit debate is that, and I don't have the numbers exactly, but my understanding is since the financial crisis in 2008, there have been more EU migrants coming into the UK than have moved to all of the other 27 countries put together. That is why it felt so acute as an issue here in the UK. Now, of course, it's because the UK economy was doing better than other European economies, so it's a good thing that's generated this. And places like London, you know, global city, always going to have and want lots of multinational, you know, to reflect, you know, the population of the world, frankly. I think we're very worried about this. The WSJA, you will hear talking a little bit less about this than free movement of goods because we're supporting others for whom it is an even greater concern. So, for example, the British Beer and Pub Association, the ALMR and other hospitality organizations put this right at the very top of their agenda. We are absolutely full square behind them. Some statistics that we've been working on, we've commissioned a report which we haven't yet published, but it basically says that the UK hospitality sector could be the third largest employing sector by 2020, if it's successful in particular, keeps growing. The second really notable thing is that 50% of those jobs are for people under 30. Now, under 30s in the hospitality sector are very, very, very likely to be those from overseas. So the problem you highlight is absolutely the right one, and it is very acute. And I don't know, I am not confident the government has the right answer to this. Quite a few of those will be students. So there is something that's been talked about, but the Tory party seem to have sort of pushed back on. But, you know, if you had an exception for students and they didn't fit within the migration cap.
Yeah, the Conservatives have ruled that out in their current manifesto.
They have. They've also U-turned on a couple of things recently, including one today. So, you know, let's hold out some hope. But I think the point is you need an immigration system that responds to what you need. The hospitality sector will not survive without some flexibility. You can't simply say, well, let's have all of those people from Cornwall that we haven't had previously. It doesn't work like that. So I think we're going to need some flexibility. In other areas, I think it's reasonably simple. So seasonal workers for fruit picking, grapes, for example. I think actually you'll be able to have seasonal visas, which is not for an entire year. I think that will be easily resolved, or reasonably easily, and the government sent good signals.
And as long as, I mean, I imagine as long as they don't get access to the social welfare system, which is what Cameron went to Europe to negotiate with, is you can come in, but you don't have access to the social welfare system, and then that was rejected. I think that would be what they're trying to get to, isn't
yeah,
it?
Quite. I think so. And actually, of course, there you can see, if you let the market play out a little bit more, it would be self-selecting who comes to do those jobs. But, you know, the hospitality sector is going to need a certain number of people from abroad, and it will probably need more people from inside the UK than it's had in the last few years. But I think that's doable. This cap on immigration could be a real stumbling block.
Just to finish up now, it does look that there's a lot of threats. I remember at the presentation or the panel, I asked what the opportunities were, and there wasn't too many coming forth, apart from maybe some dodgy tax dodgers if you're bringing booze in. But there does seem to be a lot of threats. If you're in the drinks trade or a consumer, what do you think people should be doing in terms of trying to get the best outcome for the industry?
Look, I think opportunities of Brexit do exist, but they are probably 5 or more years away. So we need ideally a smooth Brexit, but certainly Brexit to happen first, a trade negotiation with the EU to be done, and then opportunities appear.
Because we'll need to know what the landscape is before you can make an investment.
Quite. The good news there, even with that slight dilution of postponement of better news, is we can prepare for it. So one of the things that the WSTA is doing as often as possible is speaking to our opposite numbers in the trade. So there is something called the World Wine Trade Group, which has all the wine producing nations and the EU around the table. The UK has immediately been granted observer status in its own right. When we've left the EU, we understand we'll be able to join. Its governments and business, so represented usually by trade associations, sat round a table. What we are trying to do is use that group to set up bilateral wine trade deals or wine chapters of free trade deals so that they can be signed literally the day after we've left the EU. Now, it might not turn out to be the day after, but we would really hope that Australian and New Zealand consumers and particularly wine businesses are lobbying their governments to make sure that the Australian or New Zealand government do a full trade deal or a wine trade deal with the UK government as soon as possible after Brexit. That is the way in which the level playing field will be achieved most quickly. It's also the way that, I mean, frankly, wherever you work in our great wine industry, wherever in the world, it is a properly international industry. You will benefit from freer trade than currently exists. So we should all be lobbying all of our governments for our governments to do a deal as soon as possible, as soon as they're able to, which liberalizes the trade in wine. We don't want any more tariffs. We want fewer non-tariff barriers. You know, if you in New Zealand make wine differently to the way it's made in France, but your standards are equally high, which frankly I know they are, then there ought to be no barrier to those wines coming onto the UK market, ideally the EU one as well, but certainly the UK one. We could deliver that straight away. So the answer is, you know, make a noise about it. Ask government to prepare. Be ready to do a deal with the UK the day after the UK leaves the EU.
It's not just about the Australian wines coming in. We mentioned reselling. My dad used to work for a large brewery in New Zealand, and they used to import wines from Europe, but all the French wines and everything came from London because it was pulled into London under groupage and then shipped a container out of wines of Europe to where he was, and he had all his wines in one container. So it's not just, if you're drinking Rioja in New Zealand or Australia, you probably find it's being shipped through London at some point.
Yeah. And you know, that's the re-exporting that we've been talking about. I mean, I think that's really the point that I'm always trying to make. And by the way, the UK government doesn't understand this very well. The UK is the center of the wine trade, maybe not wine production, definitely not wine production, although we're doing a bit of that as well. Definitely the wine trade. You know, we really do understand this international market. It's not by accident that a small island in the Northern Hemisphere, has such a sort of hold on the international wine industry. It's historic, it's cultural, and it has long, long roots stretching out into the Commonwealth and the EU. We don't want to do anything to undermine that. We wish the UK to remain centre of the wine trading world. We wish that in the UK, but actually we think, you know, colleagues working elsewhere want that as well. So, you know, the re-exporting business ought really to get bigger, not smaller, but that will only happen as trade liberalises. So let's set it up. Let's get it going in advance. So we might have 5 lean years, but then we can follow that with better times, 5+ years away, particularly if we work harder on it in the intervening period.
Excellent. All right, then. I think we're going to wrap it up there.
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much, Miles. Cheers very much.
Cheers, Chris.